5.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. There was no time for political activism, Paul Wellstone wrote in his 2001 memoir, The Conscience of a Liberal.
We'll win this fight. We'll keep on marching and keep on fighting and keep on marching and keep on fighting until we have affordable prescription drug coverage for all the citizens in America.
Paul Wellstone made time, married at 19, a father at 20. Wellstone received his doctorate at 24, became a professor at 25, and was granted tenure at 28. For 21 years, Paul Wellstone taught political science at Carleton College in Northfield, Minnesota. He told his students, "Never separate the lives you live from the words you speak." It was his mantra, and in 1990, it was just the right message for Minnesota voters. Wellstone ran for the Senate against a well-established, well-funded incumbent, Rudy Boschwitz. The Star Tribune newspaper called him the long-shot liberal, but he did it. Beat the odds, defied the critics, and became one of the U.S. Senate's most progressive liberal Democrats. Paul Wellstone died today. A plane crash in Eveleth, Minnesota, claimed his life, as well as those of his wife, Sheila, daughter, Marcia, three staff members, and both pilots. Tonight, we remember the man who gave populism pride of place, the progressive who was usually the one in the 99-1 votes of the U.S. Senate. Joining me tonight is Jim Ragsdale, reporter with the Pioneer Press newspaper in St. Paul, Minnesota. Good evening, and welcome, Jim Ragsdale.
Good evening.
Thanks for being with us. And also with us tonight is Betty Wilson, former reporter with the Star Tribune newspaper in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Hello, Betty Wilson.
Good evening.
Thanks for joining us. Jim Ragsdale, describe the mood for us tonight in Minnesota.
There are several hundred, perhaps probably more like several thousand people with lit candles out on the steps of the Capitol right now in an icy mist. They are gathered around a tent where singing and reminiscences are going along, and parked at the curb is the green bus that Senator Wellstone campaigned in for three Senate campaigns.
Betty Wilson, what have you seen today as Minnesotans get used to the idea that Senator Paul Wellstone is dead?
I was working in the editorial department of the Star Tribune newspaper, and I saw journalists with tears in their eyes, even as they rushed around, planned what they're going to do, what they're going to write for tomorrow. They're going to, at least in the editorial page, they're going to pretty much restructure the whole page and devote a good part of it to a memorial. But when you see journalists who are that moved, you know what an impact he had. Mm.
Jim Ragsdale, we're going to be talking a lot tonight about Senator Paul Wellstone. But tell us the nuts and bolts, because we need to know, about where this leaves the Senate race in Minnesota.
I wish I could tell you. We have a half of a ballot right now, and the best information we have right now, and this may prove to be wrong because people are still trying to research the law, is that the party, the Democratic Party, either its executive committee or some group of party leaders will select someone to go on the ballot, which is only 11 days from today.
Attorney General Mike Hatch, we read, says that Democrats have to appoint a new candidate no later than 4 days before November 5th.
Okay, I didn't know that, but yeah.
And already we're seeing the names come up, among them Vice President Walter Mondale, Hubert Humphrey III, son of the former vice president, Mike Freeman, son of former governor Orville Freeman. Mm-hmm. Mr. Ventura apparently saying he would not step in the interim. Can you imagine Jesse Ventura as a candidate for the U.S. Senate?
I can't. He made it pretty clear today, which is really the only thing he said that was not a tribute to Senator Wellstone, was that he would have no interest in taking that position.
Betty Wilson, you covered Paul Wellstone for a long time and tracked his career.
Yes.
Share your memories with us. What stands out?
Well, what stands out to me maybe is way back in, I think, 1989 when he asked me to have lunch with him at a Perkins restaurant, and he told me he was going to run, and I was sort of incredulous. And
why were you incredulous, Betty?
He was an unknown. He didn't have any money. You know what he started with? His wife, Sheila, worked as a librarian, I think probably at minimum wage. She'd saved up $1,000, and she gave him a $1,000 loan to start his campaign with.
Next to nothing.
Yes. And the rest is history, of course.
Yeah. Yeah. And what did he tell you in that Perkins restaurant when you were
he
incredulous?
He told me he was going to run, and I, you know, I thought, well...
Good luck to you.
Yes.
Jim Ragsdale, what about your personal memories of Senator Wellstone?
Well, I was trying to think of, and I guess I think of him before a crowd, and it would be a crowd of believers. It might be a convention. It might be just a group at Northfield or anywhere in the state, and he is yelling at them, and they are loving it, and. And he was a skillful practitioner of the political arts. He was a good speaker. He was a he could really fire people up. And you know, he never left without adding energy to any room.
We heard him in full foam at the top of the hour there in that quote. Betty Wilson, were you the Star Tribune writer who called him the long-shot liberal in that 1990 election?
No, I don't know who that was, but that was certainly the general belief at the outset. And he's tenacious, he's fiery, he's passionate, if he believes in something, he gives it all he's got. And he showed us it can be done.
He was also involved in a very tough re-election battle, Jim Ragsdale. How was that going? The polls were extremely close. Were Minnesota voters shifting away from Paul Wellstone or not?
Well, it was a very tough and close battle against a very an equally skillful opponent, Norm Coleman, the former mayor of St. Paul. Mm-hmm. And a lot of money was being spent. There was a lot of national interest because this is one of the races that could tip the balance in the Senate, and so all you had to do was turn on the television to find out that Paul Wellstone was either a jerk or a great guy. But you know, you saw a lot of political advertising, mm-hmm. and the polls seemed to show that he was holding his usual razor-thin margin. But it was a tough fight. He was in the middle of a tough fight when he went down.
Betty Wilson, what will the legacy of this man be in his home state, in Minnesota?
I think that he cared about the people, ordinary people. He was a champion of farmers during the 80s when they were hurting and losing their farms. He was out trying to help them. Veterans just endorsed him this year. He's a hero to them because he's done a lot for them. He cared about the helpless and the people who couldn't do for themselves.
Betty and Jim, thank you for joining us tonight. It's much appreciated.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Jim Ragsdale is a reporter with the Pioneer Press in St. Paul, Minnesota, and Betty Wilson is former reporter with the Star Tribune in Minneapolis.
If there's anything I hope for, it's that while I'm in Washington, D.C., I can continue to say, and more importantly by my actions, convey to young people and everywhere in Minnesota that politics is indeed not about money and power games, but the improvement of people's lives.
That was the late Senator Paul Wellstone on the Senate floor earlier this month during debates on the resolution to authorize the president's use of force against Iraq. Wellstone was one of 23 senators to vote against the resolution. Minnesota Senator Paul Wellstone died today in a plane crash. Listeners, how will you remember Paul Wellstone? Does his death take his brand of grassroots organizing with him? And does this mean the Republicans will inherit all of Washington, White House, House, Senate, and the U.S. Supreme Court? You can join our conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined now by Harold Meyerson, editor-at-large for the American Prospect magazine and author of an article about the Paul Wellstone campaign in the September issue of that magazine. Good evening and welcome, Harold Meyerson.
Hi.
Good to have you with us tonight. Also joining us tonight from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, and hello to Harold.
And hello to Jack.
Harold Meyerson, put this in context for us. How did it happen that Minnesota put such a progressive, such a liberal in the U.S. Senate, and that he stayed there and looked on the verge of possibly having a third term in a time when America was moving conservatively, and even the Democratic Party was moving conservatively. What was moving voters behind Paul Wellstone?
Well, I mean, looking at the results of the 2000 election, not to beat a dead horse, but I'm not sure how conservatively America was moving. I would just say
we had a Democratic president who was a new Democrat, and we now have a Republican president.
That's true. That's true. Paul Wellstone really tapped into a part of the American political tradition which is still there, still rich, and if you tap into it right, can still elect you. But it is the case that most Democratic politicians don't care to do that or don't know how to do that. And Paul Wellstone both cared and he knew how. I mean, I've been going around the country covering a number of Senate and House and gubernatorial races over the last couple of months. What stands out, you know, like night and day from the Wellstone campaign compared to any other Democratic campaign I had seen, and Republican too, is the depths of feeling that people have for Paul Wellstone. This is a campaign with a vast number of volunteers who genuinely feel not only that Paul Wellstone articulates what they stand for, but that he's really not cowed by the kind of political pressures, by the kind of money pressures, by the kind of calculations that do cow most of his colleagues on both sides of the aisle, but certainly on the Democratic side of the aisle. And he's, I think, would not only have won this campaign by the small margin that the polls were showing right now, but several points more, because he has an operation up there. He has the kind of vote-pulling operation that you finally only get either if it's Tammany Hall 1925 in New York, which it ain't, or you have a lot of people who really care. One example, he has a coordinator on every – the campaign has a coordinator on every dorm floor at the University of Minnesota.
Every dorm floor.
Every dorm floor.
That is what you call grassroots.
That is grassroots, you know, green and far-reaching, and I can't think of another political figure who could command that kind of respect and enthusiasm out of young people or pretty much out of anyone else.
And that in a time when most political campaigns, certainly at the giant level of the U.S. Senate, are fought with millions poured into television ads.
And Paul had was not short on money this year, and he had his television ads too. But I have to say, I was recently looking at the campaign. I was in a large state looking at a gubernatorial campaign. Actually, the candidate is Tony Sanchez, who is a gubernatorial candidate in Texas, who has spent – he has put over $50 million of his own money in the campaign, a lot of that on trying to mobilize the Latino vote in Texas, so a major field operation. But also more than that, in a television campaign, which is producing such negative ads, people don't want to come out and vote anyway. So it's kind of a self-negating effort. That's not Paul Wellstone. And, of course, also Sanchez had to pay a lot of money for what Paul got relatively cheap, because people knew Paul, people loved Paul, and people turned out for Paul.
Jack Beatty, put this senator, now deceased, in context for us. He was often the one in 99-1.
He was a conviction politician, rare. By the way, there was a candlelit circle of students holding candles on the common at Dartmouth College in Hanover, New Hampshire, in memory of Paul Wellstone. An NPR commentator asked a Minnesota politician. He was a left wing member of the Senate, wasn't he? And this politician said, "Yeah, he was left wing. He favored shelters for homeless veterans. He wanted to increase the minimum wage. He was in favor of increasing insurance for uninsured children. He wanted parity and benefits for the mentally ill. He was concerned with the export of jobs." I guess that's left wing, all right.
Jack Beatty, Harold Meyerson, stand by. We're talking tonight about the death of Paul Wellstone, the political legacy of the Senate's leading progressive. A short correction, the clip we aired at the top was of this segment was then newly elected Senator Paul Wellstone in 1990, just after a stunning come-from-behind defeat of incumbent Senator Rudy Boschwitz. Listeners, does this tragic death today symbolize the end of progressive politics in America? Does the liberal wing of the Democratic Party die with Paul Wellstone? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're remembering the life and career of Senator Paul Wellstone, who died earlier today when his plane crashed in northern Minnesota. In 1990, Paul Wellstone was an unknown college professor when he launched the campaign that pulled off one of the all-time great political upsets, defeating then-Senator Rudy Boschwitz. With much less funding than his opponent, Wellstone relied on a grassroots campaign and a series of quirky, low-budget television commercials to get his message out.
When I decided to run for Senate, there was one thing I was looking forward to. So, as it turns out, were a lot of you.
Well, I expect that there will be some debates.
I'd love to see you debate with him.
Well, I think there should be debates, yeah.
Some people have more money than others to play with, and we're, if you debate, you're kind of standing there without money.
Getting a hold of the person I had to debate, however, proved easier said than done.
Is Rudy Boschwitz here?
No, he's not.
You don't want me to go in?
No, we don't like strangers walking around.
First, I tried his campaign headquarters.
Then let me give you my home phone number, too, okay?
Sure. I'll make sure that he gets this, and we'll get back to you.
What do you think? Do you think we should have debates around the state? So that people can see.
I'll get the message to him.
What do you think?
Glad to meet you.
No, but about these debates.
Thanks for coming down.
Okay.
Make sure he gets your message.
Okay, all right. I'll see you all.
Then I tried his office.
Is he here?
He is not here. He is returning from Milwaukee.
No luck.
I'll write my home phone.
Sure.
Is this your pen?
I'm not sure. Probably not.
Looks like a nice one. Well, I don't have a lot of money, so I'll keep this one for our campaign.
That will be fine.
I tried everything. I mean everything.
Rudy Boschwitz here.
No, not today.
Did Rudy Boschwitz call? Did anybody get a call from him?
No.
Well, if he calls everybody, let me know. Hey, you guys?
Okay, well, maybe I can find him somewhere then. Thank you very much. Okay, bye-bye.
They say he's in the cities. I don't know where he is. He's not in Minneapolis. They say he's campaigning. Then I go to St. Paul. They say he's in Milwaukee.
Rest assured, there will be debates on the key issues of this campaign. Look for upcoming dates and places. And in the meantime, if you see a silver-haired gentleman in a plaid shirt, mention I'm looking for him.
Yes, information, do you have the telephone number of a Rudy Boschwitz, please, in Plymouth?
Guerrilla politics a la Wellstone, an ad from Paul Wellstone's successful 1990 campaign for the U.S. Senate. We're talking tonight, sadly, about the death of Paul Wellstone and the political legacy of the U.S. Senate's leading progressive. I'm joined now by Josh Resnick, a former student of Professor Wellstone at Carleton College, and by Professor Roy Groh, who is a professor of international relations at Carleton College and a former colleague of then-Professor Wellstone at Carleton. Good evening, Roy Groh and Josh Resnick.
Good evening, Tom.
Tom, thanks for having us.
Josh Resnick, you were a student of Paul Wellstone when he was Professor Wellstone, not Senator Wellstone. What was he like as a professor?
You know, as a professor, he was everything that he was as a senator. He was passionate, he was enthusiastic, sincere, principled, slightly rumpled. I mean, you know, what you saw as the public persona as the senator was exactly what he was as a professor.
We quoted him at the top, having told his students, saying, never separate the lives you live from the words you speak. Did that stick with you, Josh?
It really did. I mean, he was a great orator in class. And, I mean, he just gave off such a great sense of passion and this kind of can-do attitude in class. And really, you know, coming out of the Reagan years, it was really a pragmatic world that we lived in. But, you know, here was this idealist, this visionary, and, you know, he really instilled that in all of his students.
And Professor Groh, you were a colleague. What did it look like? What did it feel like when Paul Wellstone told you he was going to run for the U.S. Senate? Did this make sense?
We didn't believe him. We knew of his energy. We knew of his brightness. He was a brilliant teacher. And he brought, as Josh is saying, a world of students into politics. But the one thing that we knew always about Paul was that he was not afraid, that he wasn't afraid to tilt at giants. He wasn't afraid to take on big interests here in Minnesota. And he wasn't afraid to think of doing the impossible. I remember the night that he declared. We went up to the cities and watched him declare his candidacy in this old rundown high school. And to all of us, it looked like Don Quixote. But we followed. And I think gradually, maybe even before people in the media, we began to see where he was drawing his strength. And he was flying under the radar. He had decades of students, and he had decades of standing on farm lines and people who were about to be foreclosed and people who were in trouble. And he touched those people. and they came out for him.
He had the real guerrilla activist approach. We heard it there in his campaign ad from 1990. Sounded almost like a Michael Moore film.
Yes.
Almost like Roger and Me.
It was Roger and Me. It was taken from Roger and Me, and to see it in person, not just to hear it, where Paul actually walked into Senator Boschwitz's office with a camera and to watch the aides in that office look at him.
In horror.
He had another ad, which is almost as tongue-in-cheek running right now. It's the one that has his opponent, Norm Coleman, at the 1996 Democratic Convention endorsing Paul. And it's running almost without words except for Norm Coleman's endorsement of Paul Wellstone as the next best senator of the United States. He hadn't lost that sense of humor after 12 years.
Yeah, Josh Resnick, how about you? Were you surprised when Professor Wellstone announced for the U.S. Senate?
You know, there were rumors about it in the media, and he talked about it a little bit in class. But, you know, again, no one really took it that seriously. I mean, people thought, you know, yes, maybe he might run, but it was more – you know, running to make a point to raise issues. No one really seriously thought he had a chance of winning.
Take us back
as a progressive liberal. I mean, he was considered a total long shot just to get the Democratic nomination, let alone to actually win the election.
Take us back to the night of his victory. What was it like at Carleton College when the long shot liberal brought home that victory in 1990?
It was pandemonium on campus. I guess the way I remember it was. The best way to put it to explain it is at Duke University, when they win the national championship in basketball, kind of imagine what the atmosphere would be like on campus there.
All hell breaks loose.
This was our national championship. I mean, when Paul Wellstone got elected to the Senate, yet rather than being Duke basketball team, he was the biggest underdog.
And the other side of it we saw tonight, I just came from the memorial service, Josh, in the Carleton Chapel. There were probably over 1,000 people there telling wonderful stories, sad stories, and to me, as an old professor at the place, the fascinating thing was that it wasn't just Carleton students there. They were coming from all over the Minnesota area. They said they just wanted to be at Carleton on this night.
It was an amazing way of connecting with people, you know, from whether they were, you know, farmers or college students or, you know, working poor, whoever it was, he really was able to connect with all different types of people.
Roy Groh, he was known as a rock the boat professor. He taught a course called Social Movements and Grassroots Organizing. Is anybody teaching such a course today?
Yes, we have in a professor by the name of Rich Kaiser, somebody who is actually a very worthy successor to Paul. He teaches from the same perspective. He's about the same stature as Paul, and he teaches in much the same manner. Mm. That course was based on Saul Alinsky, one of Paul's real heroes. And one of the fascinating things I think about Paul was that he not only taught theory, he took students out to see how it worked. Mm. And the numbers of students who followed that man, and not just for the fun of it, but who learned politics. We were reminiscing today of the number of students from our department that are peopling campaigns literally all over this country that came out of some of Paul's classes in the 1980s.
He was born 1944 to Jewish immigrant parents from Russia, grew up in Arlington, Virginia, outside Washington, and tonight, sadly, at 58, is dead. How will you remember Paul Wellstone, Roy Groh?
I'm going to remember him as a real person, as a person who wasn't afraid either at Carleton to tilt the windmills or in the state of Minnesota, or more importantly at the national level. One of the most fitting things that I heard said this evening was that he may have been a short man, but he surely leaves a big hole.
The grappling wrestler to the end there. Roy Groh and Josh Resnick, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you, Tom.
Thanks.
Harold Meyerson, I want to turn to you. You spent time with Paul Wellstone very recently in the thick of his campaign and wrote about it for the American Prospect. You reminded us in your September article of all the moments, and some recent, some a bit further back, where Paul Wellstone had been a kind of prophetic tribune years ahead of his own Democratic colleagues. Give us some of those examples.
Well, certainly, I think it's fair to say that Paul was prematurely anti-Enron or Enronism. This was a candidate who talked about corporate abuse, who talked about CEO pay, who talked about the lack of workers' rights in companies. Everything that came much more sharply into focus
with the Enron scandal.
He was one of only two senators to write a letter supporting former SEC Chief Arthur Levitt's position that accounting firms like Arthur Andersen should not provide consulting services.
Right.
75 senators wrote against separating those services.
Right. And you just needed to have the independent mind and the independent base and heart of a Paul Wellstone to separate yourself out from the huge money pressures that the Democrats just succumbed to repeatedly in matters like this. He was the one senator to go to Seattle in 1999.
The anti-globalization outpour there.
And remember, at that point, there was this phrase, which has since vanished from the political lexicon, called the Washington Consensus, that free trade was unassailable. And since then, despite the all the problems of the anti-globalization movement, mm-hmm. I think Paul Wellstone's perspective has gained more and more, and that there's more doubt, certainly, you hear among his Democratic colleagues now, and many more colleagues voting more skeptically in the more recent rounds of trade votes. But Wellstone was out there. Wellstone was out there first. Wellstone was the one senator on the National Mall back in 1993 at a gay and lesbian rights demonstration, and he was championing domestic partnership legislation mm-hmm. then. And there are parts of the country then that would have been just, you know, way off the agenda. Nobody would want to have pushed that, where this has become pretty much accepted now, certainly not all the United States, mm-hmm. but many parts of it. So he was ahead of the curve on a lot of crucial issues where only now some of his Democratic colleagues are catching up, and many of them won't.
I want to come back and talk about where that curve stands now, but callers want to join us. Let's invite them in. Scotland's on the line. Hi, Scotland. You're on the air.
Good evening. How are you?
Well, thanks.
Good. Thank you for inviting me this evening. I think two things come to mind about Paul Wellstone, and one is, how do we inject his type of leadership into a nationwide movement where people are inspired by his work and continue to carry out that in the momentum that's necessary for social change to happen? We have a very powerful economic system. We have worldwide recognition, but the critical part is that we take action and respond to the kind of issues that are fundamental to prosperity for all people in America.
Mm-hmm. Scotland, thanks for the call. I want to put it to you, Jack Beatty. Scotland says, who keeps the flame here, and how does the liberal wing, the progressive wing, keep it burning bright?
Well, in a book that he wrote about community organizing, I think it was called Bringing Energy to the Poor or something like that, when he was a professor, he said at the end, we don't live in a time now when there's a social movement and everyone misses it, because that would make it would sort of define the issues, and things that seem now impossible would be then urgent because people would be in crisis. But he said one way to do that, to sort of keep alive the flame of that possibility, is through small groups, through community organizing, through people, through voluntary organizations, people joining together to fight the local polluter, to, you know, get the town to pay more attention to public safety, to deal with power lines being sent over their houses, to stop expressways, mm-hmm. that's the way you keep alive the cells of progressive movement from the grassroots. And then when the crisis comes, and crises come, and the social movement grows, you have people who can rise, who can be leaders.
From that Democratic base, Scotland, thanks for your call. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I want to welcome into our conversation now Ellen Schaefer. She's joining us from San Francisco. From 1992 to 1995, she was senior health policy staffer in Senator Wellstone's office. Good evening and welcome, Ellen Schaefer.
Hi there. Thanks. Nice to be with you.
Thank you for joining us. You were leading a health care issue in his office when health care was at the top of the national agenda. Tonight, Paul Wellstone is dead. What's your reaction, Ellen Schaefer?
Well, it's certainly an enormously sad moment for the country and, you know, for those of us who knew him. I think it's an important time to focus on what it was that Paul did.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, we were looking at a proposal for universal single-payer health care reform in the Senate. He was a junior senator. The president was thought this was an important issue, clearly going in a different direction. And Paul's approach was, you know, this is an issue that's important to me. I'm going to combine the force of my personality, which he certainly had, mm-hmm. With the power of my ideas and take them to people. and not rely on all the money that's going to go into campaign ads and TV ads, and we know the other side has more money. I'm going to find a way, use my energy, my galvanizing force, which he was just an incredible campaigner for a short guy who limped a lot when he walked. He just had a tremendous effect on people. He said, you know, I'm going to find a way to stick with it and build the base and find the people who agree with me and get some support. And it's just such an important model, I think, for folks who continue to believe in the things that Paul held very dear and did such a great job at advancing. I think that's his legacy.
Limped more in recent years as he battled multiple sclerosis. He was called a conviction candidate. You describe him there as kind of a conviction legislator. But speak to this. He was often the one in 99-1, kind of in a competition, a playful competition with Russ Feingold in Wisconsin for who was the one most often. What does that say about the strength of that conviction legislator? I mean, was he overwhelmed by the times? 99-1 puts you in the smallest minority you can have.
Sure. I heard Barney Frank speak about this recently. He said, you know, well, when I voted that way, I always felt I was in very good company. I think, you know, there's the issue of the person himself, but then there's the issue of the ripple effect. You know, we've got Barbara Lee out here, who last year was a lone vote against a vote on the war. And, well, this year she had a lot of company. And as other people have said, you know, Paul started off on some issues like universal health care, patients' bill of rights. He was the first person to take up that issue, certainly first person in Minnesota to be as strong as he was on gay rights, very strong on education for working people and on a fair deal for veterans. And, you know, if you can stand up there with some support, with the conviction of what you believe, you do attract other people if it's something that other people agree with. And, you know, it turns out a lot of issues, many of us did agree with Paul. There just wasn't anybody else bringing us along. Now, the senators might not have gotten there yet, but I think maybe if some more of the senators can bring us along, a few or more of their constituents, we'll see the votes looking a little different. It's certainly been the case in the House.
Ellen Schaefer, is there a moment you'll remember? We just have 30 seconds, but is there a moment, is there a picture of Paul Wellstone at the rock face?
You know, I remember him joking with Bill Bradley, who was this tall basketball player, had a similar sense of humor, similar politics.
About 2 feet taller than Paul.
Yeah, something like that. And the two of them standing there, you know, kind of against the wall, just leading the way and sharing those special moments that he shared with so many people. Just inspiring each other, I think.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for the image, and thank you for joining us tonight, Ellen Schaefer.
Pleasure. Thanks.
We're talking tonight about the death of Senator Paul Wellstone, the political legacy of one of the U.S. Senate's leading progressives. Will you miss the one in the 99-1 votes that Wellstone was famous for? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. What does it mean to lose the only member of the Senate who bragged that the job meant for him a pay raise? Join us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking back tonight on the life and career of Senator Paul Wellstone, who died earlier today when his plane crashed in northern Minnesota. Despite facing a close race for re-election, Wellstone was one of the most outspoken critics of the resolution on war with Iraq.
The United States must work with our allies to deal with Iraq. We should not go it alone or virtually alone with a preemptive ground invasion. Acting alone could jeopardize our top national priority, the continuing war on terror. I believe it would be a mistake to vote for a resolution that authorizes a preemptive ground invasion.
Paul Wellstone, on the floor of the Senate earlier this month during debates on the resolution to authorize the president's use of force against Iraq, Wellstone was one of 23 senators to vote against the resolution. We're talking tonight about his life and his legacy. Paul Wellstone said he was the voice of the little guy. Was he your voice in the U.S. Senate or not? And what did Paul Wellstone stand for to you? Something essential? Something out of date? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. We're joined tonight by Harold Meyerson. He's editor-at-large at the American Prospect magazine. He spent time with Senator Wellstone on the campaign trail in his re-election bid and by our own news analyst, Jack Beatty. Harold Meyerson, talk to us about Wellstone on war. He opposed the Gulf War when almost no one did. President Bush's father, the first President Bush, called him, poultry droppings was a euphemism that the mm-hmm. L.A. Times used to describe it for attacking him on the Gulf War. This time he stood up against the president's resolution, Wellstone on war.
He did, and what was notable about his opposition this time was that he was the only Democrat in a close race, in a contested race, not just for the Senate, but so far as I can figure out for the House, and even when gubernatorial candidates have cared to raise the issue for governor, who actually took this position. There was no way, if you knew Wellstone, that he was not going to take this position. It just raised too many questions for him. About America's role in the world, about something that, as someone who comes out of, frankly, the Vietnam generation, which he did, is always a major, and he thought, again, I think, valid issue, that there was a kind of smack of imperialism about the doctrines that the Bush administration was advancing, and he wanted to be on record, damn the torpedoes, full speed ahead. He also had the same kind of position on repealing the Bush $1 trillion-plus tax cut, which the other Democratic candidates didn't want to touch with a 10-foot pole either.
But he was very upfront about saying, let's roll it back.
He was. I was with him for the better part of a week up in the state in late summer, and he would raise this in places where, believe me, he didn't have to raise it. He would raise it to sort of a basically Republican business crowd that was concerned about something like transportation infrastructure. Mm-hmm. And he'd say, by the way, if you guys really want this stuff to be built and to be paid for, we have to revisit this tax cut. So he would bring it up in friendly crowds, and he would bring it up in crowds where I think he knew it wouldn't play that well, but he felt obliged to do it, you know, in a clever way, in an artful way, but obliged to do it nonetheless.
I wonder if you talked with him about how he felt about so often being in such a small minority.
Well, he came from was an exemplar of a generation that had sort of defined itself in opposition, but I think he felt oftentimes that it was a prophetic opposition, that, you know, at one point, finally, America would move to universal health care, and that the only way that might be sustainable financially would be single payer. So I think he felt that he was not perhaps always of the moment, but ahead of his time. And, of course, other people would say he was behind his time, but I think he really thought that on a number of these issues, eventually his position would prevail.
Mike's calling from Racine, Wisconsin. Hi, Mike. You're on the air.
Hi. I wanted to point out the earlier comments about either more progressive, I guess his name came up a little bit later in the conversation, is there certainly are examples of progressives that are cut very much of the same cloth, and that's people like the senator from Wisconsin.
Russ Feingold.
Russ Feingold. And, you know, there's a rich tradition in the upper Midwest of putting what I would call, I sometimes, people in the Midwest, I think, would do a little bit of a battle with you to separate liberal from progressive. Because I think we have a rich tradition of progressivism, which can encompass both the conservative and the liberal wings.
Mm-hmm.
We're very well educated on that. If you look at how states like Minnesota, Iowa, Wisconsin choose their governors, choose their senators, choose their representatives, oftentimes there's interesting pluralities when you go through how they vote.
Absolutely, and we take your point. But, Mike, you know as well as we do that Paul Wellstone was facing a very tight race in Minnesota. How do you interpret that?
Well, as a regular reader of the Minneapolis Star Tribune, I can tell you that Paul Wellstone always faced tough races.
It's true. So, every victory a squeaker.
Yeah, it's ultimately, in the end, he always had the capability of bringing out the grassroots, the people that typically most pollsters say don't vote.
Mm-hmm.
So I think he probably would have won again. The one thing that I would make a point on, though,
yes,
and about his progressivism, and make an important distinction between Russ Feingold and Paul Wellstone, is Paul Wellstone, I think you are right in saying, was a man of conviction. And oftentimes, I think the best way to think of Paul Wellstone's legacy is that he was a man whose personal convictions happened to coincide with his constituency, whereas people like Russ Feingold, I think sometimes is willing to compromise some of his personal politics if it means being a better representative to his constituency.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's an important distinction, because some of the times when there was deviation between Paul Wellstone and Russ Feingold, I don't think it was because of their personal politics, but was really because Russ Feingold was responding to his constituency.
And Paul Wellstone was, in some degree, loved or at least seen for riding his own horse wherever it took him. Mike, thanks for your call. Steve's calling from Plymouth, Minnesota. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Hi. Actually, I'm on my way home to Minnesota right now. I'm on Interstate 94.
Good to have you, Steve.
Yeah, thank you. Why were all you feeling bad about that? You know, that Paul passing today like that.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the Paul was in a very tough race, and
he was.
I think, as your previous caller said, he would have won. I think it would have been very close. I personally, and my wife and my family, were very, very supportive of Norm Coleman, his opponent.
Yes.
And the reason that we are is that Paul sometimes almost turned into a comic on some of these issues and didn't accomplish a lot of things. It's wonderful to be in support of a lot of things he did, but as Russ Feingold is willing to compromise on some issues, Paul rode his convictions into the ground to the point like that where he didn't really accomplish a lot of things.
At that level, is there something that this senator had in common with your governor, Jesse Ventura?
Yeah, and I think that's probably one of the things that they did have. They don't have a lot in common, but he did have in common with Jesse was that they did take a real outsider approach.
And they stuck with it.
And stuck with it. However, the problem still remains is you have to get something done. Paul, really, his support was never in, he was polling less than 50%, and for an incumbent, that's very low.
Steve, thanks for your call. Harold Meyerson, how about that? As it comes down to the last few weeks here, do you have any sense of how Minnesota is going to resolve politically the loss by death of its Democratic candidate for the U.S. Senate?
In terms of...
Well, who they'll put up, how they'll put a person up, how soon they can put someone up.
I think your original guest from the Minnesota
from
Press Corps might have better ideas. There aren't a lot of big names. I mean, if you look at who's around from the state, the last Democratic gubernatorial primary, you had three sons. You had Hubert Humphrey's son,
right.
You had Fritz Mondale's son, and you had Orville Freeman's son.
Mm-hmm.
That was not exactly an electrifying group. I mean, the one name that sort of automatically has popped up this afternoon is that of Walter Mondale himself, who's
mm-hmm.
in his mid-70s, who was, of course, senator from the state and the vice president and presidential candidate in 1984. It's kind of like in this sense only, the Minnesota equivalent of the New Jersey Democrats going for Frank Lautenberg, who's also actually a little older than Mondale in his late 70s.
Mm-hmm.
There are no big names.
Do we think this throws it to Norm Coleman, to the Republican candidate?
I'm sorry, what?
Do we think that Paul Wellstone's death means that this is now likely to go to the Republican challenger, Norm Coleman?
It's a little early to say because we don't know who the Democrat
mm-hmm.
is, but I'm inclined to think that there's going to be such a sense of do it for Paul now that I think Norm Coleman, in some ways like John Ashcraft after Mel Carnahan died in Missouri just before the election in
mm-hmm.
2000,
mm-hmm.
that Norm Coleman really has got a very tough situation and he can't help himself anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, campaigning ceases at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And no, I think Wellstone would have won, and I think he would have won better than the polling showed because of he does have this amazing commitment from grassroots volunteers and because of same-day voting and their ability to...
Minnesota law allows people to,
yeah.
to walk in, register, and vote all at once. Jess is calling from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Hi, Jess. You're on the air.
Hi, good evening. Thank you for taking my call. My first original comment was to question out loud what happens next and how we carry on the great tradition of Paul Wellstone. I come from Milwaukee, and I am a very great fan of Mr. Wellstone as well as Russ Feingold. I think they're two great people that not only stand up for their convictions but do tend to vote their heart. But then the previous caller had mentioned something about not getting anything done, and I wonder out loud whether it's better to get something done in the name of getting something done, even if it's wrong. I guess I don't feel that that's a good thing. I personally believe that if you stand up for what you believe in and it's what your constituents want, then that is more effective than actually getting something done for getting something done's sake. I don't think that that's right.
Jess, we're going to dive into that. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Jack Beatty, speak to Jess's question here. I guess there's the local application and the national application of it. What keeps the Wellstone dissenting voice alive locally, nationally?
You mean in the absence of the point about his lack of achievements?
No, I simply mean to
right.
Jess's opening question.
Right.
The man is gone. And suddenly and tragically and with him a kind of take on politics that Harold Meyerson has written about in, so admiringly, yeah, of his grassroots politics. Does that stand a chance of being transplanted into national soil elsewhere? Can it thrive elsewhere?
I don't know, but I think there's an opening there, and the opening comes under the heading of economic populism. You mentioned that the Democrats had turned to the right. Well, I think you're right about that. In 1990, when Paul Wellstone first ran, George W. Bush, the president, had a health care program. He was going to give $5,000 to every uninsured person that they could insure themselves. The Democrats rejected that, not generous enough, and they waited for Bill Clinton, and we know what happened. And Bush said, I would want to give more, but I have more, we have more will than wallet. Not the year 2000, Al Gore running as a Democrat in a time of surpluses said, no, can't afford to insure the uninsured. Now, that's an example of what happened. As the Republicans have moved to the right, the center of the Democratic Party has moved right with them. And it's left this vast space called economic populism. And that, I think, which essentially says, are you concerned about your job? Do you want to live in an America where your kids can grow up with hope? You know, talks about, gets against the lobbies, goes against the corporations that are breaking laws. This is the dog that hasn't barked in American politics, and with Paul Wellstone, it barked. And you know, senators have been on the wrong side through history. One of the great senators, Senator Norris of Nebraska, ignored in the 20s, just rolled over by the old guard of the GOP. His time came in the 30s when the things that he had fought for were realized under the New Deal, and he reminded me, as does Wellstone, of Matthew Arnold's poem about his father called Rugby Chapel, who fought the good fight, a reformer who lost. And he ends the poem by saying, when the forts of folly fall, let them find thy body by the wall.
Well, and with that, we're going to close tonight. Jack Beatty, thanks for being with us. Harold Meyerson, editor-at-large at the American Prospect, thank you so much for joining us this evening. We're going to close tonight with the late Senator Wellstone himself talking about the criticism he's received for being one of the Senate's most liberal members.
Sometimes the way, you know, these attacks go, embarrassingly liberal, ultra-liberal, so on and so forth, it's like you've committed some kind of crime. It's ridiculous. I mean, but if you say, listen, I'm for living wage jobs, and I'm for protection of the environment, and I'm for universal health care coverage, and I want to focus on children and education, and I'm a reformer, I want to get the big money out of politics, and I believe in public service, and I believe government can make a positive difference in doing well for people and helping people to do well for themselves, that's what it's all about.
That was the late Senator Paul Wellstone himself talking about the criticism he's received for being one of the Senate's most liberal members. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.